Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. The Unfinished History of the Iran-Iraq War, Faith, Firepower, and Iran's Revolutionary Guards represents a fascinating and carefully documented intellectual history of how Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps document, remember, and contest the Iran-Iraq War and of its ramifications for the religious, cultural, and political history of the country. Utilizing a large corpus of a range of previously unexplored sources, Annie Tracy Samuel explains in meticulous detail and with aesthetic verve the interconnections between the Iranian Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War and the legacy of these two critical moments in relation to the Iranian state's self-imagination today. This lucidly written book should interest scholars from a range of disciplines and non-academics as well. Here now is my conversation with Professor Annie Tracy Samuel. Hello, Annie. Welcome to the New Books Network. It's a real pleasure to have you on our podcast show and a real treat to have read your book, as I was just mentioning before we began, formally began this conversation. It really is a tremendous intellectual history and institutional history that draws on a really exciting archive. And I'm very excited to talk to you about many aspects of your book. But before we get into the book, as you might know, Annie, that we have a tradition in the New Books Network that our first question is always biographical. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners about how you became a scholar.
Yes. Well, thank you so much to you for hosting this and for having me and taking time to read the book and conduct the interview. I very much appreciate it. So how I became a scholar is that I always loved learning. I loved school. I was a curious child, and I loved history in particular, and understanding the connections between past and present that seemed to be surrounding me. And I was encouraged in those interests first by my parents and then by wonderful teachers who I had in high school. And when I got to college, I knew I wanted to major in history, which I added a minor in political science to. But my interest in becoming a scholar really began during the process of writing my senior history thesis, which was an undertaking that was very challenging, but was also one that I found really rewarding and that I found I enjoyed so much that I wanted to continue doing it. I wanted to continue projects like the one I had begun for the thesis. So I made a somewhat last minute decision to apply to graduate school and to focus on Middle East history, which I had become interested in after taking a class on the Middle East in college. And so I decided to focus on the Middle East, on the history of that region, being intrigued particularly by its complexity, by how confounding it is. And in grad school, I focused on the Middle East. And then especially under the supervision of some great mentors, I decided to focus especially on Iran. And that has been the main focus of my scholarship since then, although I have coupled that with additional interests in international relations and U.S. involvement in the Middle East.
Terrific. So I thought as a first question to begin our conversation, it might be helpful for the listeners to find out a bit about the broad context and theme of the book. And perhaps I think the best way to do that would be for you to perhaps speak a bit about two of the key categories in the book. One, of course, is the organization IRGC, on which the book focuses. What is that? And why is that, central to your book? And secondly, perhaps I could have you talk a bit about the title of the book, and especially the two key terms of faith and firepower, how they figure into the larger theme and the argument of the book. Maybe that might be a good way for us to make an entryway into what this book is about.
Certainly. Well, I'll start by sort of setting out the main subjects of the book, one of which you mentioned, which is the IRGC. And the IRGC is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and it is one of the two militaries in Iran and has existed since the 1979 revolution in that country. And it's an incredibly powerful organization that is not only a military, but that really consists of an agglomeration of military, political, economic, social, cultural, and other endeavors. And it has expanded dramatically from its initial post-revolutionary beginnings, and particularly through its involvement in the Iran-Iraq War, has become one of the most powerful institutions in Iran today. And that, of course, is the other main subject of the book, which is the Iran-Iraq War, which was a brutal war fought between the states of Iran and Iraq from 1980 to 1988. So I examine both the IRGC and the Iran-Iraq War in terms of two main themes. One is the idea of unfinished history, that the history of the war remains unsettled and incomplete and unfinished. And the second, as you mentioned, of faith and firepower. And the second of those themes, the one of faith and firepower, comes from a slogan that was used during the war on the Iranian side, which held that the faith of Iran's troops is stronger than the superior firepower of Iraq's troops. And that has come to symbolize, that sentiment has come to symbolize some important truisms, what have become truisms, I think mistakenly, about how we should understand Iran today. And it has come to mean that faith was the only thing that was important for Iran, that religion and revolution are what drive Iran in everything that it does, including it in how it prosecuted the war. And so what I try to do in the book is to say that, yes, the role of faith, broadly construed, is certainly important in understanding Iran and how it prosecuted the war. Firepower, meaning military professionalism, strategy, weapons, firepower is just as important for understanding how Iran prosecuted the war, in understanding what the IRGC is, and understanding the Islamic Republic of Iran more broadly.
Wonderful. Before we get into the ways in which the IRGC has remembered and narrated and documented the Iran-Iraq war and some of its implications, which is the bulk of the book. I thought before we get into that, it might be useful for us to discuss what comes in the earlier part of the book, which is basically the documentation of the war and the kind of infrastructure, I guess the institutional and discursive infrastructure that went into making this archive possible. So I was wondering if you could actually speak a bit about your archive first. You know, what kinds of sources did you consider and examine, and maybe connect that to the larger sort of documentational infrastructure, so to say, that the IRGC amassed and depended on in assembling the kind of archive that you then examined.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely. So this is a question that relates, I think, to how this book really came about. And it came about because of the sources that form the basis of the book and the arguments I make in the book. And the project began as a PhD dissertation, as many first books do. And the dissertation was initially looking at the rather broad subject of Iranian foreign policy in the 1980s. And I was on a trip to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. to look for various sources on that subject. And in the course of that research, I found a very large collection of sources produced by the IRGC, which I hadn't heard anything about and which I found very surprising. Everything that I had known about the IRGC suggested that it was a powerful and ideological military, and that it wasn't in the business of producing the sorts of sources that I had found. And these sources were large. They were quite scholarly and academic and well-referenced, and they were extensive, and they all focused on this issue of the Iran-Iraq war. And so when I came across these sources, I knew as a historian that I was really on to something. And so I made those sources the focus first of the dissertation and then of the book. So what these sources are is, most broadly, they are a history of the Iran-Iraq war that has been written by the IRGC. And they consist of a range of historical publications produced primarily by what is now known as the Holy Defense Research and Documentation Center. Holy Defense or Sacred Defense is how the Iran-Iraq War is often referred to in Iran. So the Holy Defense Research and Documentation Center is a branch within the IRGC that is solely devoted to documenting and writing the history of the Iran-Iraq War. It used to be called the Center for War Studies and Research, but now it's called this Holy Defense Research and Documentation Center. And that project, this center and the publications it has produced, began very early in the IRGC's history, which extends beyond the war by only a period of about a year and a half. But this project began just about 6 months into the war, in the spring of 1981. And it began when the IRGC established what they called a War History Division within what was then called their Political Bureau. And then what became the center was established in 1985. But what this War History Division of the IRGC Political Bureau did is that it began training what were called war narrators to essentially observe what was happening in the course of the war, to observe what was going on, to interview key actors prosecuting the war, to collect documents, to make recordings, and to assemble all of that information as the war progressed. And that's indeed what happened. And so we have a really unique project of a revolutionary organization that is very new itself, finding itself fighting an interstate war that it was not designed to fight, and understanding right away that this was an experience that needed to be documented. And so that's what they set about doing. So over the course of the war, the IRGC collected thousands and thousands, more than I know, pages and other kinds of records of documents over the course of the war. So they focused on documenting the war for the entire 8 years that it was ongoing. And then when the war ended, this Holy Defense Research and Documentation Center shifted to organizing and cataloging all of these records, and then producing historical publications based on those records. And so those publications consist of several different things. The most important is a series called Chronology of the Iran-Iraq War, which will be, when it's complete, 57 volumes, each of which focuses on a particular period of the war, usually of about several months. Not all 57 have been published, but there are 57 that are planned, and the war has been divided up into these, what will be these 57 volumes. And each chapter in the volume is a day of the war. And there's analysis of the major military and political events on that day, excerpts from news sources, examples of sources, primary sources that the IRGC collected. And so that's a massive and really valuable series that I draw on a lot in the book, and that is really the most important of these IRGC sources. But then there are several other series that address the history of the war in a number of ways. So there's two series that trace the war's evolution chronologically. There's one series called Critique and Review of the Iran-Iraq War that looks at difficult questions like why the war began, why it continued for as long as it did. There are several series of atlases that look at how the war played out in different Iranian cities and provinces, atlases that focus on specific battles and some that focus on specific military units. And there's a series on the oral history of the war, where the IRGC historians work with commanders to document their history. So that's the trove of sources, the sort of institutional archive that I use to build the arguments and construct the history that I present in the book.
Terrific. Now turning to a major theme of the book, which is how is the Iran-Iraq War narrated by the IRCG? Then we'll come to some of its implications and consequences. But one of the things that I found really fascinating, and it's something that you very convincingly show in the middle part of the book, is that the relationship between the Iran-Iraq War and the moment of the Iranian Revolution. And what you show in the book is that this relationship actually is one of considerable ambiguity, in that at times that the Iranian Revolution is seen as a hindrance to the participation or successful execution during the Iran-Iraq war by the IRCG, or how it remembers this moment. And at other times, the revolution is seen as a positive force or a helping force in terms of this war. So I was wondering if you could speak about that dynamic of how it was seen as a hindrance or a facilitator of the successful execution of this war, and maybe in terms of how it was a helping force, if you could also speak a bit about the significance of the epic of Khorramshahr and how that was seen as a turning point in how this war was remembered.
Certainly. And this question of the relationship between the war and the revolution that preceded it by about 18 months, I think is incredibly complex and ambiguous, as you said, and quite interesting, both from a historical perspective in terms of how we understand Iran and this Iran-Iraq war, and also from a theoretical perspective, because it helps us understand what the relationship between revolution and war are. And this is a subject that the IRGC historians, as you said, approach with a view that prizes complexity and to a certain extent evinces some ambiguity. So the argument that the IRGC historians make is that the war was very much connected to the revolution, but they describe the connection in a way that is a bit different than the manner it's usually been discussed in the secondary literature that's been written in English. And in much of that literature, the common contention is that the war began because Iraq felt threatened by Iran's revolution, and particularly by the threat to forcefully export this revolution abroad, specifically to Iraq. And what the IRGC historians argue is that the connection between the war and the revolution stems most fundamentally and most simply from the timing, from the fact that the war began so soon after the revolution occurred. And while the revolutionary transition was still underway. So they acknowledge that the revolution was seen as a threat, was perceived as a threat by Iraq and others, but they characterize that threat as sort of fear of what the revolution might do or become, sort of a confrontation that was intrinsic to the revolution itself, rather than policies to actively export it. And for the IRGC, what's so important is to understand, again, the timing, that this war began in the midst of a transition that had started but not yet ended. And that was intentional in their estimation, because Iraq made the calculation that this was the time to attack Iran, when the threat of the revolution was such that it could be effectively countered, that the revolution was not yet institutionalized, and so it could be effectively dealt with at that point. So the idea was to attack Iran at a time when its armed forces in particular were in a very weak and transitory state, when the regular military that had been held over from the previous regime had been severely weakened and demoralized, when the IRGC was barely getting itself off the ground and was in no way prepared for a conventional war like the one it was about to face. And so conditions like that provided the opportunity for Iraq to invade and also made it incredibly difficult for Iran to prosecute the war, especially in its initial, certainly its initial couple of months and then in its first sort of 2 years. And so during that period, the revolutionary transition was ongoing in a manner that hindered Iran's war effort. But at the same time, the IRGC historians also assert that in some respects, the revolution helped the war effort because it helped to mobilize the population to fight the war. People in Iran were sort of already mobilized because of the revolution. So instead of settling down into sort of more normal, non-revolutionary times, people were still active and were prepared to engage in confronting the Iraqi invasion. And people also viewed the invasion, the IRGC historians assert rightfully so, as an attack not just on the country or the nation or on the territory, but on the revolution. And so this view that there was so much at stake at the war, that they were fighting to protect their country and their revolution, helped people contribute to the defense and helped them prosecute the war. And I think we can see that especially in this epic of Khorramshahr, which you mentioned. And that Khorramshahr is a city in southwestern Iran, in the province that's known as Khuzestan, which borders Iraq. And Khuzestan province is where much of the fighting actually took place. And Khorramshahr was the site of two of the most consequential battles and some of the bloodiest battles of the war. First in Iraq's efforts to occupy the city in the first months of the war, which it did successfully only after its second attempt to do so at the end of October 1980. And then the city remained under occupation until Iranian forces were able to retake it, which was in the spring of 1982. So for a year and a half, the city was occupied. And the retaking of Khorramshahr for the Iranian forces was sort of the culmination of this overall reversal in the war that allowed them to finally liberate the territories that Iraqi forces had occupied. And the successful campaign to retake the city represented a case where faith, where the revolution could be used effectively in battle. And that's because of the particular way that this battle was fought, the way that the IRGC helped organize the campaign, how they relied on sort of less traditional military tactics to overcome what was still Iraq's superiority in firepower.
Wonderful. Now, turning to another key theme of the book, which is also mentioned in the title as well, which is this idea of the war as something unfinished, as something that, you know, may have ended in terms of how we, in terms of a historical event, but it continues as an important normative force in the imaginaries of the members of the Revolutionary Guard until today. Could you speak a bit about that theme and what it means to your actors, this idea of the war as unfinished, and why is that such an important idea, both to these actors and to the argument of your book?
Great. So the war remains unfinished, I think, in several respects. First is that it ended inconclusively. So even though it formally did come to an end, it did so in a really inconclusive manner for both sides. And I think especially for Iran, as it had attempted to go on the offensive in the summer of 1982 in an attempt to force recognition of its ceasefire terms. And it was only partially successful in that. And in the process, that invasion of Iraq led to 6 years of really brutal stalemate and to a lot of wasted blood and treasure. And so looking back on that, looking back on the inconclusive way that the war ended, has meant for the IRGC that the war remains unfinished. It really never came to a satisfactory conclusion. So that's one way the war remains unfinished. Another way is the fact that the IRGC and Iranian leaders more broadly have used the Iran-Iraq war as a learning experience. They understand how important this war was and is, and they have accordingly made efforts to derive political and strategic lessons from the war, particularly lessons relating to how Iran can better protect its national security and how it can prevent, in particular, another war of the kind that began in 1980 from breaking out. Deterrence is a principle of national security that many countries prioritize, but it's particularly important for Iran, given that it was invaded and it was thrown into this 8-year-long war. And so Iranian leaders and military leaders like the IRGC specifically are very much concerned with establishing deterrence, of correcting the failures that led to the outbreak of the war in the first place, and to learning from the overall experience of the war in terms of how to better defend the country. And that has led to efforts, for example, to ensure that Iran is self-sufficient when it comes to defensive technologies, that it is not as isolated as it was during the war, that it can maintain its independence and its national sovereignty, and so overall what it can learn from the war. Iranian leaders also see the war as continuing in terms of the fact that they view the sort of enmity against the Islamic Republic that the war embodied as having continued after the war. One example of this is the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, especially as a result of its nuclear program. And Iranian leaders often tie this, the issue of the nuclear program and how it's been a focus of international concern for so long, as sort of the continuation of the kind of opposition to the Islamic Republic that has existed since the revolution and that took shape most violently in the Iran-Iraq war. So their efforts to continue to defend the country like they did in the war continue and remain unfinished because efforts to confront Iran, to limit its independence and power also continue. And then last, I think the war is unfinished because its legacy remains potent and remains in transition, especially as it recedes further and further into the past. And as new generations come to be born in Iran who didn't experience the revolution and who weren't alive during the war. And the IRGC historians are very concerned with ensuring that the war's legacies live on, that people who were born after the war and even those who experienced it realize how impactful it was and understand how essential sort of keeping the history alive is. And so they've devoted themselves to that endeavor in a way that is ongoing. And so their contributions to the history of the war also remain unfinished.
Now I want to return to another major theme of the book that you spoke about earlier, but that you return to in the book as well later. Or in the later part of the book, which of course is this relationship between faith and firepower. And one of the key points that you make in the book, and you make it really convincingly, is that the common perception of the Iran-Iraq war as just having been animated by considerations of religious fervor, etc., are a bit misplaced. And you nuance that idea to show how faith and military prowess were in fact negotiated in some very interesting ways during the war, and also how they're negotiated in terms of the afterlife of the war, so to say, or the continuing life, I should say, of the war, so to say. So could you speak a bit again about that key theme and that argument of your book of not just reducing the memory of this war just to religious motivations?
Yes. And I really like how you put it there, right? It's about not reducing the war to purely religious motivations. And so what I wanted to do was to not to argue that faith, that religion weren't important. Quite the contrary, they were immensely important. But what I wanted to do was to complicate this notion that it was all about faith, that Iranians were completely animated by religious fervor, were sort of irrationally obsessed with martyrdom, with sort of religious principles and religious callings, that this war was completely subsumed within a larger crusade to liberate Karbala from the Iraqi regime, and then to march onward to liberate Jerusalem, which I think is characteristic, unfortunately, of the way that Iran has been portrayed for too long. So as I said, faith, religion certainly are important, but it doesn't mean that they were everything. And so we should understand the war for what it was, that it for Iran, it was a war that was fought, especially in the first 2 years, in defense, in response to a foreign invasion. And faced with this foreign invasion that it was in no way prepared to confront, Iran had to rely on all of the tools at its disposal, which included both faith and firepower. And one of the reasons why faith was so important to Iran was that it was one of the very few areas that it had the advantage over Iraq. Iraq had superior weaponry, superior support, superior firepower in sort of all the senses I use it in the book, in all respects throughout the war. Iran had immense difficulty securing weapons and spare parts and any of the kind of sort of military material it needed to fight this war. But what it did have was a relatively committed population and a relatively more committed soldiery. Iraqi soldiers had quite poor morale. During the conflict, whereas Iranian soldiers, for most of it at least, had much greater commitment to the war effort. And so what the IRGC sources argue is that that was a real benefit to Iran, having a larger population and a more committed population was a real benefit to Iran, was one of the few areas that it could be stronger and it could use effectively against Iraq's superior firepower. But at the same time, they don't disregard the importance of weapons and strategy and military professionalism. And we can see that in sort of a number of ways, in how the IRGC professionalized quite quickly and quite fundamentally over the course of the war, as a result of its understanding of how important that was to its ability to prosecute the war anything nearly successfully, and also in terms of the efforts to secure weapons in whatever way that it could. One example of that is the Iran-Contra affair, where Iran made the decision that interests had to take precedence over ideology, that its interest in attaining weapons that it needed for the war had to take precedence over an ideology, holding that the United States was an enemy of Iran that should not be dealt with. And that is, in fact, what happened in the Iran-Contra affair. So the idea is to again complicate this picture, and to understand how both faith and firepower were important to the prosecution of the war, and to understanding the IRGC as an institution today.
As a final substantive question, I wanted to ask you about the significance of the war today, or the significance of the history that you tell about the war today. You begin the book with this narrative about three very different ideologically positioned actors on the Iranian scene in the contemporary moment being on agreement with the one thing, that this is a war, and especially the treatment of the U.S. during this war that Iranian society will never forget. But I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the significance, the importance of this story, this history that you tell in this book, for these actors, the IRGC, but more broadly in terms of the contours of Iranian politics and society today.
Yes, certainly. Well, I think the significance of the war today is quite difficult to overstate. For the Iranian public, people are still very much living with the legacies of the war, even as new post-war generations are being born. There are still many, many people who continue to live with the scars of this war. And in terms of politics, it also continues to have a really fundamental impact. One of the issues where we can see this is the nuclear issue, that Iranian leaders understand the confrontation over its nuclear program in terms that have been very much informed by the Iran-Iraq war. That, for example, Iran's distrust of the international community to abide by its own laws and norms is something that is intimately connected to the Iran-Iraq war. That Iran's distrust of the United Nations in particular comes from the war, from the UN's failure to condemn Iraq as the aggressor in the war for many years. for its failure to condemn Iraq's use of chemical weapons. Iran sees things like that as having important lessons for how it should engage with other countries today, that it views international engagement as something that should be done with the utmost caution, and that it should be very wary of trusting other countries, especially with Iran's own security, that any interactions or any compromises that have the potential to make Iran less independently secure should be viewed with great skepticism. And in that light, I think we can understand the difficulty of concluding the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, in a new light, and understand why it was so difficult for Iran to trust the UN, to trust the United States. Of course, there were difficulties on both sides of the sides trusting Iran, but of course, I'm speaking of the Iranian side now. So how challenging it was for Iran to undertake that kind of engagement, and then what it meant when the United States withdrew from the nuclear deal. That for Iran, that seemed to justify the sort of warnings that I describe in the beginning of the book from very different leaders, including Supreme Leader Khamenei, the former Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, an IRGC commander, who all connect Iran's ongoing distrust of the United States specifically to the Iran-Iraq war, and make the case that if relations between Iran and the United States are going to improve, this distrust stemming from the war is going to have to be addressed. So that's sort of about the political influence of the war. But I'll also say, just to conclude and briefly, that I think the importance of the war comes too from how history is viewed and how the IRGC views history. That they view history, somewhat surprisingly, as absolutely critical, really as an imperative, that they understand that the role that history has in shaping national identity, in shaping political culture, and shaping the sort of common imaginary. And they want to work based on that understanding and to realize the need to ensure that history isn't lost and that the history of the war is kept alive.
The Unfinished History of the Iran-Iraq War, Faith, Firepower, and Iran's Revolutionary Guards by Professor Annie Tracy Samuel, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Thank you so much, Annie, for your time, for the generosity of your time, and for this really exciting and fascinating book, and for your very lucid and analytically profitable answers to my questions today. I'm sure our listeners really enjoyed the conversation and will learn a lot from it, and as well as they will from the book too. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So this was my conversation with Professor Annie Tracy Samuel about her wonderful new book, The Unfinished History of the Iran-Iraq War. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which, remember, operates online through the New Books Network. I hope you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast. Note it, name it, NBIS. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.